am. David Sirita is my guest. He is a remarkable guy who's interviewing a remarkable guy, Boyd Bushman. I suggest you all cruise on up to the website, coasttocoastam.com, and take a look at the documents that are there, the document that is there. Certainly, if this craft really was flown by the United States, it would explain an awful lot of sightings, that we had then and now, wouldn't it? God, it's incredible. And I want to find out a little more about how David got on to Mr. Bushman. More of all this in a moment. Well, all right, David, I'd like to go back and find out, if I can, how you got on to Boyd Bushman.
Okay, well, that I mentioned that briefly, but John Hutchison, Canadian scientist John Hutchison.
I know him well, yes.
You know him well. He's been on your show. John and I are friends. John actually said, David, you want to interview Boyd Bushman. And he's at Lockheed, and I just said, okay. And then I started writing Boyd letters, and, you know, about 8 months ago or so, and we started getting into these email conversations. We spoke on the phone, and it was just so brilliant. I love speaking to elderly, you know, knowledgeable individuals, whether they're scientists or explorers, because it's kind of like when you think of the Native Indian tradition, they pass down their teachings to the next generation orally, you know, through word of mouth. And I felt like he was doing that. I felt like, you know, when I finally met Boyd, it was like he decided to, you know, pick me because I have been diligently working in these fields for many years, for decades, actually. And I was close. I mean, my schematics and in fact, I started having dreams after the UFO I saw in 1968. I started having dreams about the propulsion system. And it's so close when you finally find out how anti-gravity works. It's amazing. There are a lot of kids. In fact, in my film From Here to Andromeda, I interviewed these four or five kids in this family, and they claimed they saw a UFO in the eye of Hurricane Katrina while they were living in Florida, and you know, when it was coming over the eye. And one of the girls started doing this thing with her hands, you know, showing me how the lights or the waves in the UFO were moving in a particular field pattern. And they were identical to my dreams. They're identical to what is happening in crop circles. Crop circles have a language for, you know, particle physicists who look at photographs and bubble chambers of the trails that subatomic particles leave. That's an actual language that I'm very familiar with. So when you're looking at these kind of wave patterns, you can understand what they mean. And here was this girl, and she must be like 11 years old, doing the same thing with her hands that I saw in my dreams.
Mm-hmm. And let's come back for a second to Mr. Bushman. Can you sort of tick off for me what his first person claims are?
Well, his patents. If you go down the list on his patents, I mean, he's got...
No, not so much his patents, David, but his claims with regard... We've already heard what he says about Roswell and about the craft that was, he says, shot down. But again, that's through another individual.
Right.
When I say first-person claims, anti-gravity, that's his, correct?
That's his, yes. And how it works, is very specifically, is his work.
And he claims that this technology was back engineered from the Roswell craft or other craft.
I think it's more than the Roswell craft. I mean, when we get into Roswell with him, you know, on camera, and you start asking him, what is his access and what was involved in the steps and the procedures towards not just disclosure, but also to, you know, actually finding out how these craft work. He makes that statement that he can only show me from a white world form information from that form. And John Hutchison, I mean, these guys study everybody. I mean, Lockheed Martin, I mean, you look at all of our top defense contractors, believe me, they study everybody. And if John Hutchison had something that was beyond them, he would have been hired by now. But they're way ahead of him. They're interested in him, and they're probably interested in why and how Hutchison stumbled upon anti-gravity. And sometimes the Hutchison effect works, and other times it doesn't. So the question is why. And then there are other researchers, you know, people like Bob Lazar that were of great interest to Boyd Bushman. And, you know, there are many people. But when you get into the black area with him, he suddenly, I mean, he loses his sense of humor and he locks up, and you can tell you're not going to get any further. But personally, he personally demonstrates the different phases that lead to anti-gravity right in front of me and gives me enough information with what I already know that I can do it myself. In fact,
all right, well, what exactly did he demonstrate for you, and what did you capture on film?
Okay, the first thing is a very simple experiment. It's this little thing called a celt, or a rattleback, if you look it up on Wikipedia. They were found in ancient Egypt and in England, in early explorers in England found these things. And essentially what they are, they look like an ark or a canoe that you spin on your table. I have one. In fact, I spin it. I should make a little video of this and put it on the Internet. And what he says is, according to Newton, you know, Galileo, Newtonian, Einstein's physics, once you set something in motion, it tends to remain in motion unless it's acted on by an outside force. And all forces are equal in opposite directions. So your positive and negative forces in your atom, this is what physicists believe today, cancel each other out to a big fat zero. And I've always believed that wasn't true. I've always believed there's something called differentials. Now, when you spin this thing counterclockwise, it spins very freely. When you spin it clockwise, it starts to vibrate and rattles back and wants to go back counterclockwise. Now, he says,
wait a minute, David. If you start something in motion, it does not continue in motion indefinitely.
Unless it's acted upon by an outside force, and the outside force is called inertia. Inertia is...
Okay.
Okay. So now when you spin this thing clockwise, it starts to vibrate and then goes back counterclockwise all by itself. And what that tells us is that clockwise and anticlockwise are not equal. The counterclockwise force is slightly stronger than the clockwise force. And those forces are around us all the time. And it's very similar to gravity and the expansion force in the universe. They're not equal. One of them is slightly stronger than the other. The entire universe is made up of atomic structures that are positive and negative charge. They're all in this state of duality. Traditionally, most particle physicists have believed that those two forces, that the force of the electron cancels out the proton and to an absolute zero, and that is not true. Now, what are called differentials is the difference or leftover force between those two forces. Differentials open up another dimension of force, another dimension of energy. So that's the first experiment he does in front of me. Then what he does is he does something really quite amazing, is he takes magnets that are north-north. You know what happens if you take two magnets and you push them together north-north and they start to repel?
Yes.
Okay, very simple, right? Well, what he decides to do, he believes that gravity and magnetism and electromagnetism may be related to each other. And in fact, at the time of the Big Bang, at this enormous temperature of the Big Bang, all of the forces were one. They were all together. They were kind of melded together. And as the universe cooled over billions of years, the forces separated. So he thinks that they are related. So what Boyd does, and he actually holds up a document from what I'm about to say, is he takes a north-north magnet, $5,000 a piece, super magnets, and he drills a hole in the center of them, and he bolts them down on a shaft, so they're forcing them together so hard. He says they produce a field. Remember, these are $5,000 magnets, which you got to spend a lot of money on if you want to do this. And he bolts them down, and he wraps them in this kind of plaster to make it look like a rock, right? And he measures this field 3 feet wide on all sides of this thing. Then he goes up, just like Galileo, you know, back in the early days in Italy, when he drops the falling bodies off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And then according to Galileo, in fact, this was done on Apollo 15 on the moon, if you drop a feather and a hammer, it doesn't matter how much two different objects weigh, they fall at the same speed towards the Earth. They both have different energies, but they fall at the same velocity. He goes up to a tower in Lockheed, and he actually holds this document up stating the date and time when he did this test. And he takes an ordinary rock that looks just like the rock that has the opposing field $5,000 supermagnets in it. He drops them both 9 times, and he gets these guys that he said are uneducated and have no knowledge of Galileo, and he tells them to hand him the rock that lands first every single time. They hand him the rock that has no opposing field magnets in it. So his opposing field magnets take longer to hit the ground than its neighbor. So what that demonstrates, in fact, that is groundbreaking in itself. That is
very interesting.
That's very interesting. So it's a 59-foot tower. In fact, I just emailed Lex the actual document that he holds up on your webmaster, so he should put it up on your site. And he does it 9 times, and it cancels out a – so I said, boy, that if you can cancel out even a percentage of gravity – even a percentage of it, the amount of fuel you would need for the space shuttle to go into orbit would be much less, right? Well, what happens when you amplify that effect? And what does, if you look at north-north, the two north sides of a magnet or south-south, what does that look like as a waveform? It's really interesting here because
how much difference was there in when they hit the ground, and are we sure that they left at the same time?
Oh yeah, no, they left at the same time. I mean, there's no way a guy like Boyd Bushman would drop them at different times. I mean, it would be very precise, 9 times in a row to be sure. It just keeps happening. Now
and then, how much difference, just out of curiosity, between when they hit the ground?
I didn't get that information. I actually, you know, was very curious of that information myself because, you know, 59 feet is not very far, but neither is the Leaning Tower of Pisa very high. So now what's important next is what he shows me next consecutively in the interview is this nuclear-powered amplified version of that experiment being lowered by this huge crane into the belly of a classified aircraft. Mm-hmm. So that now what happens is, if you apply more energy in the opposing field, you're going to cancel out more of gravity. You know,
right.
You see, so that's what they started doing. That was the beginning of canceling out gravity, was using nuclear propulsion. Now let's look what happens, because the Betty Cash case in Texas, this woman Betty Cash and her son and her mother, they see these Army helicopters chasing a flying saucer, or what we call a UFO, that is blazing red hot and glowing like the sun, and this thing is kind of wobbling along. And where is it happening? It's happening in Texas, and that is exactly where Lockheed's headquarters is. In fact, Lockheed, when I was there just about a month ago, in the newspaper, you know, in the local newspaper, they were showing how much money all the different defense contractors got in the last year, and I think Lockheed was around $27 billion. They were the cream of the crop. They were way beyond Boeing, and of course, Lockheed Skunk Works is where all the black projects are done. So, what he's showing me is that if you amplify this effect, I mean, two $5,000 magnets may only cancel out, who knows, 10% or 20% of gravity. I don't know the exact amount, and I can get that information. But if you amplify that, then it starts to get more and more interesting. If you can cancel out 50% and then 100%, then once you cancel out 100% of gravity and inertia, tiny thrusters of energy, ion thrusters, electric ion thrusters, will send you thousands of miles an hour.
Sure, you'd be able to go to orbit without even breaking a sweat.
And you look at the shuttle program, the Apollo program, you know, and you think, if these guys were doing this in the 1950s, nuclear propulsion, this is what I believe the true use of element 115 is. You take element 115 and you put it in opposing fields, electromagnets, not just, you know, magnetized magnets as we use. We use ferrous or iron material, and we magnetize metal and turn it into an actual magnet. But if you use nuclear-powered electromagnets, essentially what electromagnets look like is they're ferrous material wrapped with a Tesla coil, right? The more windings, the stronger the field gets. So what happens is if you really know what that looks like in a waveform, if you take a clockwise spinning electromagnet coil and you cut it in half, and you look at and you turn it on its side, one of them will look like it's going clockwise, and one of them will look like it's going anti-clockwise. Because what you're doing is you're taking two north-north and you're slamming them together to produce a field that Boyd Bushman says cancels out, that gravity no longer recognizes that object anymore because of what you've done to the field. Now, I did some research today on NASA's very own website, and I found something. I started looking up Galileo and, you know, falling bodies, tests on falling bodies, and I found some admittance there that there were deviations depending on, not as detailed as Boyd Bushman is giving, but there are some deviations on the tests on falling bodies that are being done today. So it is not 100% flawless. You know, Galileo and Newton, and getting Newton relying on Galileo's test, we have a discrepancy there. So that is as much as he's admitting on the first level of the test, but then he's personalizing it and showing me on an amplified scale that that's what's going into the belly of these craft. Now, what I discovered, when you convert energy into electromagnetism, which is essentially radio photons at that point, which is what Tesla coils do, you're taking mass and converting it into light, and then you can convert light back into mass again through Einstein's photoelectric effect. Essentially, what I discovered was that you guys are throwing all of this energy away in the field, and if you could recapture it, recycle the radio photons, you could do the same thing with a lot less energy. And I actually, you know, gave Boyd Bush and my schematics, my drawings of how that would actually work, and they're actually looking at that. So I believe one of the reasons we are not seeing anti-gravity nuclear-powered 100%, you know, gravity-canceled craft flying around in our airlines and in the war in Iraq is because they're highly radioactive. I mean, they're using a lot of nuclear energy to produce the effect. But somebody has figured out how to do it with a lot less energy. Because one of the things Boyd told me was that when they examined the Roswell craft, they didn't find any electricity or requirements for such a thing. So the only way I can answer that, I mean, no generator, no requirements for electricity, a translucent material that you can actually see through. I mean, the only way you can answer that question is if you can cancel out your mass gravity equivalent to zero, and you put that in Einstein's formula, if your mass is zero and energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, what is zero times the speed of light squared? Zero. So how much energy does it take to go to the speed of light squared? Zero. So that would mean you don't need a power source. Once you have transformed your mass and you can cancel out gravity, maybe you don't even need a power source. Maybe at that point consciousness or thought, which is a very low amplitude, very weak waveform, is enough to tell it to move left or right or do whatever. I don't know at that point. But I do know that if once you cancel out your mass gravity down to zero, it's not about energy anymore. It's not even about an energy source. There, and that's where Boyd starts to get into force number 7, 8, and 9, which are the higher forces. In the very end of my interview with him, I asked him point blank, and remember, Ben Rich, who was former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, said that we now have the technology to go to the stars. We now have that.
Well, if that's true, David, then we now have the technology to begin to power our needs here on Earth without doing what we're doing to the Earth, and that's about the only way we're going to save our own butts.
Exactly, and I think that's why he's giving this out, because like we said in the beginning of the interview, if you can cancel out even 50% of the weight and gravity relationship of a motor vehicle, electric cars can go with 500, 600 miles on a single charge. So, and what does that energy cost? According to the article I read in Popular Mechanics or Popular Science on the ZapX, $3.50 right now on electricity will take you 350 miles. If you can double that, $1.50 is going to take you 350 miles. So energy isn't going to be a commodity in the future.
Did Mr. Bushman point you toward anybody who can corroborate what he said?
Well, yes, because the experiments he does right in front of me, the next experiment he does right in front of me, and these get really interesting. He takes a Tesla coil, which is
all right,
just...
Hold it right there, because we're going to find out about that experiment, also something... apparent knowledge about some sort of mysterious purple wave that struck the space shuttle Columbia. All of that with David Sirita coming up in a moment. Yeah, that's right. We still have a moment. What am I talking about? there is something regarding the space shuttle Columbia, right, David?
Yeah, that's in my film as well. I've really gone into this in a very deep level.
All right, but it's going to be in your interview as well. Tonight, now.
Yeah, we can talk about it, yeah.
How did you become is this also something he told you about?
Actually, when I brought that subject up to him, he got very disturbed, and I didn't want to ruin the rest of my interview. He got very disturbed,
as in he had knowledge about it, or...
It looked like he didn't have knowledge of that, but I can tell you this, I mean, just as a cameo into that subject, I interviewed an investment banker named George Mosman, whom with his attorney in Dallas, Texas, that day the shuttle went down, had his Zeiss binoculars, and he saw two metallic flying saucers.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back. Here indeed I am. David Sirita is my guest. He's got some blockbuster stuff to be sure. Listen to me, everybody. Those are the numbers. They're there for a reason. If you've got a question about anything you've heard thus far, I've got David Sirita. So in a moment, we'll start taking calls and questions from all of you. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, all right, David, I want to be very careful here. You know, it says on the paper that we all get when we do interviews as last question or last talking point. Let's talk about why and what you know about the mysterious purple wave that struck the space shuttle Columbia. Now, that's sensitive stuff. That's going to upset a lot of Americans. And I wanted to first be clear about whether it actually came from your contact, came from him or came from you, or where it came from, whether it's been confirmed or whatever.
Actually, after the show we did on Christmas Eve, I think it was, one of your listeners actually sent me all five photographs that were taken by the British astronomer who was noted in the San Francisco Chronicle. There was the article in the San Francisco Chronicle that stated that a purple corkscrewing wave struck the space shuttle just moments before we lost contact with the space shuttle, minutes before, and that this British astronomer took five photographs with a Nikon 800 digital camera, and each exposure is 4 to 6 seconds long. Somebody sent me all five of the photographs. I am not legally allowed to put the photographs in my film, but because they're so simple, legally I'm allowed to do artistic renderings. NASA never disclosed the name of the individual who took the photographs, but he reveals himself when somebody accidentally or through NASA just put his photographs on the Internet, and he demanded they take them down. And, of course, he reveals his identity, and his name is Dr. Peter Goldie. He's actually a head of a philosophy chair in England. And he's the one who took the photograph. So we know from the San Francisco Chronicle that this actually happened, that these photographs were taken. Without disclosing the photographs to the American public, the Chronicle stated that, the shuttle was struck by something called super lightning. Now, if anybody knows anything about lightning and knows that lightning reaches its target virtually almost instantaneously, and it can only flash for about, in fact, the longest lightning strikes I test in my editing bay, in my video editing bay, are about 1/3 of a second. That is the longest strike I have in New Mexico from the ground to a cloud. Most of them are about 1/10 of a second or less on an actual video frame, which means a video camera pulses at 30 frames per second, and on top of that, you have exposure, or you could have 1/1000th of a second on each of those 30 frames, or 1/4 of a second, for example. So there's no way a lightning strike could exist over the different photographs that Peter Goldie took. And when we actually look at his actual photographs, whatever this purple corkscrewing wave is, it's coming from above. The shuttle is doing it about 12,500 miles an hour, which is about Mach 18. And this thing doesn't strike it instantaneously. It seems to aim straight at it, and it kind of spirals towards it. And then when it hits the point that it thought the shuttle was at its time of launch, or whatever this thing is, it course corrects at 90 degrees. And it's probably doing 15 or 16 or possibly 20,000 miles an hour. It course corrects at that speed at 90 degrees and chases after the shuttle. That's in photograph number two. And in photograph number three, remember, these are 4 to 6 second exposures. There's no way a lightning strike can show up in any more than one exposure on a still frame, on a digital camera or on a film point. So there's no way this is lightning. And if it was lightning, it would have struck its target instantaneously in one frame. So because, you know, he has to repress the shutter on his tripod and take another picture, 4 to 6 seconds long. The sun hasn't yet risen yet. It's 5:53 a.m. San Francisco time, which is where he's taking the photograph. And on the third photograph, you can clearly see this purplish corkscrewing wave has struck the shuttle. And the shuttle was just a bright white line preceding this exact moment because it's streaking by over 4 to 6 seconds. There's no camera movement because he's on a tripod. So you get this kind of pure white line going from left to right in the frame. And then in the frame where you see that it struck the shuttle, the shuttle gets brighter. It's like it flares up, but it doesn't explode. And this alleged lightning strike no longer goes anywhere else. It's reached its target. It's delivered its energy or whatever it's done. It doesn't look anything like a lightning strike to me. And then in the fourth and fifth photographs, there's no evidence of any fraying. It doesn't, you know, go in any other direction. So it's definitely has actually struck the shuttle. The shuttle's a lot brighter. And then just minutes later is when the last transmission from the space shuttle, you know, occurs. So what we have here is what is so interesting about this is that it's moving at a velocity. So it's not behaving like an electromagnetic pulse weapon. It's not an EMP weapon, which is just a big flash anyway. It's not a missile because most of our missiles don't go anywhere near that fast. They go, you know, maybe Mach 3 or 4 tops, including the Stinger and the Sidewinder and anti-tank missiles. I've gone down the list of all of our missiles. The only missiles that can go 18,000 miles an hour are the ICBM family, and those are your nuclear missiles. And there's no way a nuclear missile was launched at our space shuttle. So that's out of the question. So the question is, what is it? And when I finished the segment, it was really kind of amazing. When I finished editing the segment, I'm not saying I know what it is, and it definitely doesn't look like a Tesla death ray. That's for darn sure, because that would strike its target almost instantaneously. It would not have to course correct and, you know, chase after the thing. But
all right, David, you've given us so much information across so much territory here. I want to allow some of the audience to ask you questions. Mm-hmm. All right? Is that all right, David?
Sure, yeah, let's go.
All right, good. All right, let's do it. Andy, you're Andy in Florida. You're on the air with David Cerita. Hi.
Well, hi, Art. Hi, David. I've been listening to you for 20 years, by the way. I love your show.
Thank
I had
you.
To say that. I first time called it. I wanted to confirm, I was really shocked when David talked about nuclear-powered flying saucers. In 1976, I had finished my, I just entered the University of Colorado, and my major was physics, and I flew on an airplane, Swiss Air flight, from New York City to Zurich, Switzerland. The man next to me saw that I was reading a physics book, and he opened his briefcase, and he showed me diagrams of a flying saucer, and showed me photographs of a flying saucer that he said he helped develop. And he said he was on this flight because the government was deporting him from the United States back over to Europe that he had been captured during the war. And the interesting thing about his flying saucer was that it was nuclear powered.
Wow.
And he said that was one of the problems with the general public wouldn't be able to deal with flying objects around that were nuclear powered. But he did tell me that it would go supersonic. It was over Mach 1. And he said it could lift a payload, hover and lift a payload larger than the sky cranes of those days.
All right. Have you seen the documents, caller, that are up on Coast to Coast right now?
No, I haven't. I just now, I'm a truck driver. Just now stopped. I haven't had a chance to look and see those. But I did want to, can I give the guy's name that was sitting next to me? It might be.
No. I would very much prefer you do not do that.
Okay.
But yeah, email it to me.
What's that?
You can email it to me.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to email his name. He said he had a company in California and that he had owned this company and that the government had gone in and taken all of his research materials and all of his prototypes and all of that stuff. And shipped him back out. He was also said that he was good friends with the Einstein family. So there should be some trail or paper trail behind it. But very interesting stuff. I just had to let somebody know that.
All right. Well, that is interesting. And I'll tell you what. Listen very carefully because I'm going to let David give out his email address
right.
So that you can send this to him. David.
All right. I will.
Go okay. On. It's very simple. It's just David Cerita, Cereda at hotmail.com.
David Cerita at hotmail.com. That's easy enough.
Yeah.
Is this how many individuals like this one have you run into, David, who also make similar claims?
Well, actually, I just got an email. I just checked my emails during the break, and there's another individual who has a very similar story, actually, in California, describing, that he accidentally stumbled upon these documents when he was working for a particular contractor, and, you know, it's a very similar story. But another thing, Michael Schrat, who's another UFO researcher, he has documentation from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base of a scientist who personally reverse-engineered and built a nuclear-powered saucer. And we're trying to confirm if it's the same name or friend of Boyd Bushman's who designed this particular one, or who actually, you know, was one of the senior scientists on this project. Now, we know from you know, the Majestic documents that, of course, who would, once you have all these generals, you know, sequestering the Roswell craft and other crash retrievals, who do they bring in? They bring in scientists, because scientists are the only ones who can understand how these things work. And that is what Boyd Bushman is. He's a senior scientist. He is definitely, in my opinion, one of the most brilliant scientists, probably the most brilliant scientist I've ever met in my life.
Does he claim that he's had hands-on with alien craft?
I couldn't get that out of him, no. I couldn't get those exact words, but I think I can deduct that from the conversation. I think maybe I'll get that on camera before he dies. He's 73. He has, you know, diabetes. I don't know how much longer he's going to be around, but I think maybe I will eventually get to that point. I do believe he understands, and I asked him the question, do you think we will survive as a species on this planet? And he gave me the most incredible answer. He said, the first question is there life? Are we alive? And are we passionate about life? And those who are alive, he believes you're not alive until you found your life's passion. And he said, those who are alive are going to figure out how to escape this planet and find another one. So I think he believes that we are not going to survive, and that is why he's giving us anti-gravity, enough information that we can engineer it and start canceling out gravity and saving a lot of energy. And eventually,
all right, David. All right, here comes Bill from Long Island, New York. You're on with David Sarita.
Mr. Sarita, plane manufacturer, Learjet, John.
John Lear. Yeah,
he maintained that we had a second program with going to the moon and stuff. And Mr. Bushman's revelations sort of give credibility to that claim by Mr. Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to hear your comments on that, whether you believe does this put Mr. Bushman in any kind of danger?
I don't think it puts him or me in any kind of danger, and here's why I believe that. I believe, just like the telephone, if you think of the Bell curve, Alexander Graham Bell, you know, by the time these scientists have perfected and re-perfected this type of technology in a research lab, and they've moved on to things that are much more, you know, advanced of this. And I think, you know, Boyd is pointing to the 7th, 8th, and 9th force, and that the 6th is anti-gravity. If we've had this since the 1950s, then it's time that it gets out, because humanity can benefit from this. We can solve zero-point energy and global warming with this knowledge. We can move on to a higher level of civilization, and I think he wants that for the world. The only people who are going to be threatened by it are oil companies that are going to go out of business anyway, because the oil.
Well, that's a big threat,
and that is a big threat.
It is important in this interview, David, that we separate what Mr. Bushman believes or what his opinion is, mm-hmm. and for that matter, yours, from what he's claiming as actual fact, hands on.
Right.
I know this to be true, kind of actual fact, and what he said certainly would back up what. What John Lear has said, and
definitely, I've met John Lear, and John Lear told me that most of the UFOs we see are ours, and there are alien craft, but they're much more rare. And I think I believe that at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would also back a lot of what Lazar has said.
Absolutely, I believe after talking to Mr. Bushman that Bob Lazar is for real. He had true access. But I don't think he's a know-it-all. I don't think he understands how these things work. In fact, Lazar.
Well, he never. Now, wait a minute. Yeah. He never claimed to understand exactly how they work.
Yeah, I know.
His claims were quite limited. Mm-hmm. Although he certainly claimed hands-on. He claimed.
Yeah.
And by the way, his claims have always been very consistent. They've never been enlarged on. As you do interviews with Bob Lazar, you get the same story every time.
Where is he today? That's what I want to know.
I think he's over the hill in Las Vegas. First time caller, or maybe not. Maybe in New Mexico. I don't know where he is right now. Ray in Indiana, you're on with David Cerita.
Hey, Art. Hey, Dave. He kind of answered the question. My question was, why isn't technology being used right now? And I wouldn't question it if I haven't, you know. I did see something, and of all dates, April the 1st, kind of sort of that technology. It's kind of weird, up in the air. And I wouldn't have said anything if I wouldn't have seen it twice. I saw it twice, and it was kind of weird. It's kind of weird. I could see it with my sunglasses, and once I took off my sunglasses, I couldn't see it. And I was comparing it to a jet, you know, an airplane coming from the west, and I could see that ball. It was just a chrome ball up in the air, and then all of a sudden it takes off to the east.
Okay, so you're telling us about a sighting you had. Do you have any questions, Ray, for David?
Yeah, why that technology is not being used if it's out there, you know, if it's I saw it myself, and why?
Okay,
and
millions of Americans have had similar sightings, and it is a very good question, David. If you have the answer to it,
well,
if all of this technology exists, where is it in our moment of need? And certainly, the moment of need arrived some time ago.
Well, like I said before, I don't think we have a need to be flying around anti-gravity craft as civilians, but I think there are certain uses to anti-gravity, as I mentioned before. If you can reduce the weight of a vehicle in relation to gravity, it takes way less energy to move it around, and we can get off foreign oil and a steady curve towards sustainability. So
then why is it not public?
It is. I mean, in my film, literally, step by step, one small experiment after another, you can figure out how to do this. I really believe that Boyd Bishman has given us the answer in From Here to Andromeda. If you look at it, if engineers look at it, and I think I understand it, I can, you know, duplicate it. It's not
that complicated. You say here, you've heard that there's a plan underway to release some, if not all, of this material in the near future. What do you know about that?
Well, they'll never release all of it when you consider the bell curve. They're not going to give us, because I asked Boyd this at the very end. I didn't get to say this yet, but I said, could we get to Andromeda, 2.2 million light years away from here, and that's the name of my film, on the 7th or 8th or 9th force? And he said, absolutely. There was no question in his mind at the end, absolutely. And for a man with his background to state that, not modestly, absolutely, is remarkable. And when you consider that, if we're already, as Ben Rich states, you know, we already have the technology to go to the stars, not the planets, but the stars, then anti-gravity is just the tip of the iceberg. It's enough to transform humanity and save the planet, yes. But it's not the whole enchilada. I mean, there's a lot more. And I don't believe they're going to give us all that yet.
Yeah, but it'll do for now. Kimberly in Portland, Oregon, you're on with David.
Hi, David. My question is specifically about the difference between the alien craft and the craft that we've manufactured. You said a while back that Mr. Bushman specified that, you know, there are their crafts and then there are our crafts. And I actually had a sighting of a triangle craft, and they seem to be a little less prevalent, but maybe increasing here recently. But I'm wondering, did he specify anything about, you know, the triangle crafts in general, or about the difference that generally the alien crafts tend to be a certain shape, or do you know anything about that in particular?
Well, actually, the statement was by Ben Rich, who was the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who said there's their craft and there's ours. Boyd Bushman is very explicit in detailing that, yes, there are. He does actually state that in the interview, that there are alien craft that are actually here, and then there are ours. So, yes. The triangles, when you think of a case like the Phoenix Lights, you know, a mile-wide triangle, I'd find it hard to believe that that's one of ours. Also, just prior to the Phoenix Lights, one of my witnesses in my film, George Mosman, and his sons were camping in the Anza-Borrega State Park on the Mexico-California border, and they saw an equal-sized mothership in 1995, and they made drawings of it. So I don't believe those are ours, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, what do I know?
All right, David. Apparently, you know quite a bit. David Sirita is my guest. Top of the hour. We're going to continue taking calls for David Sirita into the next hour. I'm Art Bell.